This is where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Have you heard of the Vinland map? Its acquisition by Yale in the mid-1960s touched off a decades-long controversy over whether it was an authentic Viking map from the 15th century. Its discovery cast doubt that Italian explorer Christopher Columbus was the first to discover the New World. Coming up, we hear from Yale's Beinecke Museum, which owns the Vinland map. Mystic Seaport will also join us to explain why the debate over the map's authenticity helps shed light on 20th century American history. Now, the last time you visited an art museum, did you wonder whether the paintings before you were original masterpieces or duplications? You can join the conversation this hour, 860-275-7266. Email where we live at WMPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Later in the show, we'll hear from two experts on the ways museums, collectors, and auction houses confirm authenticity. But first, we're talking about all this today because of Connecticut's connection to what's been called the most valuable art heist in history. Earlier this week, Robert the Cook Gentile, a Connecticut mobster, was to learn what his sentence would be for pleading guilty to weapons charges. Now, what does this have to do with the Gardner Museum heist in 1990? To tell us more, we're joined now by Stephen Kirkjian, a Boston Globe reporter who has covered the Gardner Museum theft since the late 1990s, also author of Master Thieves, the Boston gangsters who pulled off the world's greatest art heist. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Before we learn a little bit about Robert the Cook Gentile, tell us again about what happened that night in 1990 at the Gardner Museum and what exactly was taken.
Yes, it were 13 pieces that were taken, and it was a very daring and very cunning robbery pulled off by two men who, after midnight, around 1 o'clock in the morning on March 18th, 1990, rang the side door, the employee's entrance at the Gardner Museum, and told the two night watchmen, at least the night watchman who was at the desk, security desk, that there was a disturbance and that they had come to investigate it and they wanted to be let in. And the hapless security night watchman at the desk broke the protocol and allowed, and he knew he was not supposed to let anybody in, but never before had a police officer come to the door. But he broke protocol and buzzed them in, and that began what turned into an 81-minute. The two robbers tied up the two night watchmen and put them downstairs in the basement. But that began a rampage within the museum, in which they stole 13 pieces, including what is considered at least three masterpieces, two large Rembrandts, including his only seascape, Storm in the Sea of Galilee, and a Vermeer, one of 35 known Vermeers, the Concert. And in all in another large Rembrandt, in all it's 13 pieces stolen, valued. If there was an open market for such masterpieces, they're said to be worth $500 million. So this is it's regarded as the largest art heist in world history. 28 years, the FBI has labored diligently, as a museum security director of late, and they have chased down every lead. Mm-hmm. Including into Mr. Gentile's house, and but come up with nothing. In fact, the FBI told me in 2010 that they had not had a single proof of life sighting of any of the artwork, which means they've never had anybody come in with a remnant of the stolen pieces to prove they had access to them, or a photograph.
Now, Stephen, you mentioned there's no open market for these masterpieces that were stolen. So who would have possibly taken them? Like, what are the leads that you found through all your years researching and covering this story? And, is it rare that they haven't turned up this long?
It's rare that they haven't turned up, but masterpieces like this sometimes take decades to show up. The smaller pieces that may be stolen from a gallery will often be, most often be insured, and then there will be a dialogue that will begin with the thieves and the gallery's insurance company. to get them back at a much reduced price. So there is sort of a netherworld that takes place of bargaining with stolen pieces. But those are the lesser pieces. These are the major pieces, and these happen very, very rarely. And when they do happen, they can be gone for a long time. 28 years, I think we're getting now to the outer limits of a long time, to the point that they're being missing for such a long time, values the beauty and the magnificence and the importance of the art. So, and as far as theories, the one theory that seemed to populate here in Boston as I did my reporting for my book was that a stolen art of this nature, a Rembrandt like this, is considered a, quote, get-out-of-free-jail card, unquote, in which the bad guys can try to, think they can, begin a process of negotiation with the authorities, be the state or federal, in which they can get a break in prosecution or a break in incarceration for a person who's an associate or a loved one.
So enter Robert the Cook Gentile, again, a Connecticut resident. You mentioned that if you steal something that is this valuable, it can be a get-out-of-jail-free card. That wasn't the case for Mr. Gentile. Tell us about how he entered into this fascinating mystery.
Well, Gentile had been interested with a very close friend of his, had been up in Maine, who passed away in 2004, but he had been, at least for 10 years before, been interested in getting his hands on the artwork. He knew, because there was a $5 million and now $10 million reward for the return, there's another world, a level of people who would try to do anything to get their hands on the artwork, both to get the reward or to negotiate a deal with the FBI. And why do we know this, that Gentile was involved, is because when they searched his house in 2012, they came upon a copy of the Boston Herald, a competitor of the Globe, from the day of the robbery, the day after the robbery, covering the robbery, and inside that paper was a sheet of paper, was a typewriter sheet of paper, and on that piece of typewriter paper was a listing of all the pieces, the 13 pieces, and what they would get on the black market. Gentile was able to convince the feds when they confronted him with this, because Gentile has long said he has no knowledge of the whereabouts of the artwork and never had his access to the artwork, but he was always trying to get his hands on it so he could get his hands on the reward. And so when they confronted him with this piece of paper, he said, well, I didn't draw it up. It was drawn up for me by a fellow who knows the art world better than he. And that individual is a Worcester car dealer who knows Gentile a bit. And he confirmed to me that, yes, he had drawn it up. Mm-hmm. But again, Gentile has long been interested with these paintings. This is totally his account. The feds don't believe him. The feds believe they buy an account told to them by the widow of his best friend. This fellow lived up in Maine, but had very good connections down in the Boston underworld. And he was a more major player in the Boston underworld. And this friend's widow said to the feds, the FBI, and the museum security director in 2010, that before my husband died in 2004, he gave several paintings to his good friend, Bobby Gentile. And so in 2010, the feds came, the FBI came, knocked on Gentile's door and said, we know you have the paintings. Your best friend's widow told us you have them and we want them back. And if you give them back willingly, show them where they are to us, we'll avail you of what then was $5 million reward. Well, Gentile said, yes, I've been told them his story. Yes, I've been interested in trying to get them, but I never had them. Well, the feds didn't believe him, and they set him up in a sting that he fell for. And so he's been in jail for the last, 6 years. He's been in jail for 5 of those years. He continues to fall for the stings the feds set up, and he will stay in jail.
So he was supposed to be sentenced for pleading guilty to a weapons charge. That right. sentencing was delayed earlier this week. Is this any indication? I mean, would he ever, if he knows where these paintings are, did the federal authorities still think that they could get this out of Robert the Cook Gentile?
You know, it's what they have at their command is to try. They're convinced that he does have access, somehow does have access. He has continued to, despite his continued denials and his lawyer's protestations, that the man doesn't know anything. His lawyer, Ryan McGuigan, a very well-known, respected criminal defense lawyer there in Hartford, has said to the authorities, and Gentile was on his deathbed a year ago, September, and a year ago this month, and McGuigan went to visit him at his prison cell and said to him, "It's ending now. Get these paintings back in the hands of the museum. They belong in the hands of the museum." And a very compelling quote that he said to him. He said, talking to Gentile, "Bobby, there'll be thousands of Gentiles, there'll be thousands of McGuigans coming and going over the years. There's only one Rembrandt. There's only one Vermeer. Give them their paintings back so people can appreciate this artwork. You know, this is historic. Painted only once. Appreciated millions of times. Now for 28 years, missing, gone. Help them get the paintings back, and the reward will go to your family." And Gentile broke down and cried and said, "I don't have them. I never had them, and I don't have them." So he has consistently said, in fact, I interviewed him, Ed Mahoney from the Hartford Courant has interviewed him, but I interviewed him at his house in 2014 when he was out of jail for a bit. And I spent 5 hours with him trying to convince him that the right thing to do was to give the paintings up, and how he got them. But he consistently denied that he ever had any access to the paintings.
This is Where We Live. I'm speaking with Stephen Kirkjian, a Boston Globe reporter who's covered the Gardner Museum theft. This, again, were 13 very valuable paintings were stolen from the Gardner Museum in Boston in the late 1990s. 28 years later, the federal authorities still don't know what happened to these paintings. And Stephen, we heard from a listener, says what's really interesting about this whole story is that the most valuable pieces in the Gardner Museum were never targeted in this heist.
Right.
Your book is titled The Master Thieves, the Boston Gangsters Who Pulled Off the World's Greatest Art Heist. These Boston gangsters, are we to believe that all of them have passed? And no one will ever find these paintings?
Well, not all the gangsters have, but you know, there is a coda within the underworld that you don't snitch, and so I think that coda has to be addressed, because I do think even the FBI and my reporting on different people who did the theft, those people are dead. But there are some people within their underworld gangs who know things, and it's those people who have to be convinced that it's in the public's best interest, in their best interest. These bad guys, these members of the criminal underworld, they have families, they have children, they have grandchildren. Those children and grandchildren would appreciate and be inspired by these pieces of artwork once back on the walls of the museum. It is a sin that these are missing from Boston, from the museum, and from the art world, and they were put on those walls in these galleries, the Dutch Room and the Short Room Gallery at the museum, by Mrs. Gardner to inspire the next generation of artists. And it's an absolute truth.
You mentioned
the rarity that took place, but now with them missing for 28 years, our children don't see them. Our grandchildren don't see them. This is ridiculous.
Stephen, you mentioned the reward. I believe that reward's now up to $10 million. It'll expire at the end of this year. Personally, again, you've invested a lot of time in this case. Do you think that this will be the year?
I'm working on a podcast where the Globe and WBUR mm-hmm. have agreed to partner with a podcast that with members of WBUR staff. I'm working on with them, and hopefully we will advance the story, but the mystery remains. And my hope is that the museum and the FBI agree on a public outreach campaign. It has worked immensely to raise money for ALR research, And that kind of campaign should be, I think, can be applied to this case to get the public more aware of the value of these missing paintings and the value of getting them back, and also opening up for the brighter angels of the members of the underworld who know something but have refused to cooperate because there's nothing in it for them. There is something in it for them. It's their children and grandchildren to appreciate this artwork back on the walls of the Gardner Museum.
Stephen, for those of us who have not been to the Gardner Museum, if people go into that Dutch room, they will see these empty frames that have been there for years.
Yeah, I akin it to walking into a wake. You know, when you walk into the wake, the sense of loss from the old photographs, from the heavy scent of the flowers. I mean, you in a place, you have a feeling of loss when you walk into that Dutch room where once stood the magnificence of Rembrandt's only portrait of the sea and the Vermeer, and another major Rembrandt. Those paintings are missing. They've been missing for 28 years. It's ridiculous. And I think that it's time to have a public outreach to say this loss has to be remedied. This has to be these paintings have to be brought back.
I want to thank Stephen Kirkjian, again, a Boston Globe reporter who's covered the Gardner Museum theft since the late 1990s, author of Master Thieves, the Boston Gangsters Who Pulled Off the World's Greatest Art Heist. Stephen mentioned he's working on a podcast, The Boston Globe, with WBUR on this heist. We'll look forward to it, Stephen. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up next, what methods do museums and auction houses use to detect forgeries? And if something's fake, does that mean it doesn't have value? We'll find out, and you can join the conversation, too. 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. In the art world, how do museums and private collectors know what's authentic and what's not? Sure, if you've got the right training, sometimes the truth is pretty obvious to the naked eye. But for well-done forgeries, how have advances in technology helped experts decipher whether the art before them is the real deal? Joining us to explain is Leila Amina Dole, art and cultural heritage attorney and professor of art crime law at New York University. Leila, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Also with us, Jennifer Mass, president of Scientific Analysis of Fine Art and the senior consulting scientist for the Rijksmuseum. Jennifer, welcome to Where We Live.
Oh, thank you so much.
I'll start with Leila. I understand you teach a class on art crimes at NYU. Earlier, we were talking about the art heist at the Gardner Museum in 1990 in Boston. What are some other really famous examples of theft in the art world?
I think one of the most famous examples deals with one of the most famous paintings of all time, Leonardo da Vinci's The Mona Lisa. It was stolen in 1911. It had gone missing for over 2 years and eventually was recovered. But the theft actually is what made that painting one of the most famous paintings in the world.
That's interesting that it makes it more valuable and more famous. What about the screen? What happened there when there were actually two versions that were stolen?
Yeah, there were four versions of the screen that had been made, and two of them were stolen. One of them was stolen from a museum, and eventually that was recovered as well. But again, it made the price skyrocket once it went on the market. So it's interesting that buyers are often more inclined to pay a higher price if a painting has an interesting history behind it. It's a great story to tell at a cocktail party that it was stolen and recovered.
Now, we were hearing from our earlier guests that there's no open market for paintings and other things that are stolen from famous galleries. So who are the people that are taking these?
I think a lot of art crimes are kind of crimes of opportunity. People who aren't necessarily selling the works on the open market, because as you stated, there isn't a legal market for stolen works. And once a work is stolen and it becomes very high profile and known to have been stolen, then it's impossible to sell on the market. So these works go underground. These works are often hidden. And if they are sold, they're sold for a fraction of the actual value.
I mentioned that you're an art and cultural heritage attorney. Tell me who your clients are. When do they contact you?
I have a mix of clients. So some clients contact me prior to purchasing an object in order to help them with due diligence to ensure that a work isn't stolen or isn't fake. I have other clients that contact me after there's a problem, once they do have a work stolen and they're trying to have it recovered. I also do work with governments and consulting on cultural heritage laws and art laws. So I have a mix of clients, and I work touches upon all different types of art crime, whether it's theft or authentication or simple, or shouldn't say simple, more, you know, basic contract matters, relationships between artists and galleries. So I touch a lot of what's happening in the art world.
Let's talk about forgery. And again, I want to bring in the conversation Jennifer Mass, who is a scientist, president of Scientific Analysis of Fine Art and senior consulting scientist for the Rijksmuseum. I understand that you and Layla sometimes work together. Tell me, as a scientist, who you help in terms of finding out like what actually is a forgery or not?
I'm somewhat similar to Layla in that I have clients from all sorts of the areas within the art world. I do work for museums and for auction houses, for collectors and dealers, basically anyone who's got a question about the attribution of an object, the state of preservation, and the authentication of an object.
Can you walk us through the process of how you decide whether something is legitimate or a forgery?
Oh, absolutely. It starts out actually pretty low tech, just looking with the naked eye, seeing if you have any suspicions visually in terms of, for example, the impasto, the way that the paint was applied, and looking for any evidence of oxidation of the canvas that you should expect for a painting that's supposed to be even 50 years old or 200 years old, and then just taking out an ultraviolet light. One thing that I think people don't look at enough is that oftentimes a painting can be expertly faked, but people try to fake the provenance of the painting as well by putting labels onto the back of the work. And so sometimes the pigments that are used on the painting can be perfectly appropriate, but the papers that are used on the fake labels will be from the wrong period, and that can show up very quickly under ultraviolet light. Once we've done those non-destructive methods, then we can do some additional sort of standoff non-destructive methods, such as X-ray fluorescence, which gives us the palette of the work, so the different pigments that the artist used, and we can find out if there's any anachronistic materials there. And then it becomes a matter of interpreting the data, making sure that we're looking at something that was original to the painting and is not a later restoration. Because it said when you walk through a museum, about 80% of what you're looking at is the hand of the artist, and about 20% is the hand of the restorer and the conservator. And so there's collecting the data and then interpreting it.
Because we know a modern science has really evolved and helped you decipher what is a forgery, the people that are making these forgers who are doing this, are they also using that to their benefit?
Oh, they absolutely are. It's become something of an arms race in terms of we get better and better at detecting artist materials, and then they get better and better in terms of using the appropriate materials for different periods so that we won't have something show up that's anachronistic. And so we try to take things then to the next level and say, okay, if you have a pigment and a binder, for example, an oil painting that's been together for 200 years, what's the chemistry that should have gone on between the pigment and binder over 200 years? And if we don't see that chemistry, then we could potentially have a problem as well. So as they get more sophisticated, we get more sophisticated.
This is Where We Live. Today we're looking at how private collectors, auction houses, museums find out whether what they have in their collections are authentic. On the phone with us, Jennifer Mass, president of Scientific Analysis of Fine Art, LLC, the senior consulting scientist for the Rijksmuseum. Also, Layla Amina Dole, art and cultural heritage attorney, professor of art crime law at NYU. Layla, can you add to this idea, these modern-day forgers and who they are and the process that they use to try to get away with the crime?
I think the stories involving forgers are really fascinating, and everyone loves hearing about these stories because they're very interesting individuals. Many of these people are extremely talented. They're very talented artists. who haven't necessarily been successful for their own artwork. So in order to, you know, make money and find success, they forge others. And there's a gamut of people who forge works. The very famous case that had occurred within the past decade was a case involving the Nodler Gallery. And the forger involved in that case was an immigrant living in downtown New York City. He wasn't really making much money from his forgeries. Instead, it was the middleman who was making millions of dollars. But he was a talented artist who was able to fake the style of others. On the other hand, there are forgers who make a ton of money off their works. Forgers who have works enter museums and very reputable collections. And I think some of the personalities of these people are very interesting. They're fascinating to the public, particularly the ones who are able to dupe the art market and kind of pull one over on the experts.
There's money to be had if they can get away with it. But is there ever an element of these the forgers who are highly talented but may have been spurned in the art world? Is this their way of getting back?
Oh, definitely. That's definitely one of the reasons that they give for forging. I'm not really sure if that's just an excuse and it makes them look a little more valiant and interesting, or if it really is just financial gain that they're looking for. But many of these forgers have said that. An example is Hans van Meegeren, forger, a Dutch forger from the early 20th century, who ended up forging works, and the Nazis ended up buying works by him. And one of his issues was that he was a talented artist, but he wasn't really recognized for his talent. So instead, he forged other painters. So that is definitely one of the common excuses given by forgers.
I wanted to go back to Jennifer Mass. Some other really high-profile cases of modern-day forgers, I believe Wolfgang Beltracchi, if I'm saying that correctly. What can you tell us about him?
Oh, well, this was a fascinating case in which he had done a wonderful job of forging all these different artists and really gotten away with it very successfully until a conservator and scientist colleague of mine in Germany did scientific analysis of some of his work and came up with an anachronism. In this case, it was a 20th century pigment called titanium white. And so Beltracchi was caught, and he ultimately went to jail for his crime. But I think it was fascinating that he was interviewed when he was coming out of prison, and they asked him, if he had to do his life over again, what would he have done differently? And he said, well, I certainly wouldn't have used titanium white. And so the forgers are really keeping us all on their toes in terms of, we have to be very careful what we publish in terms of original artist materials and techniques, because then we're really making essentially a forger's handbook. We're telling them what to do next with the next generation of forgeries. And so we find all this great information about objects of art and then have to keep some of it to ourselves.
It's interesting. The Wolfgang Beltracchi story. There's a really great profile that 60 Minutes did. We're going to tweet it out at Where We Live. But do you have a question for these experts when you go to the museum, or maybe you have a private collection? Like, how do you know what's real, and is it to your benefit to find out the truth? The 860-275-7266. If you want to join in on the conversation here on Where We Live, I'm going to take a quick call. Robert's calling from Milford. Robert, you're on the show.
Hi, I have a question for the guests. Do you have any opinions about some of the foundations that represent the modern, postmodern pop artists who are accused often of denying provenance and denying even the science of these artists, or the science of proving provenance, just because they're very often accused of doing this to protect their own franchise?
Okay, great question, Robert. Layla, can you take that one?
Sure. So it's an interesting issue regarding artists and their rights to attribute works themselves. So under the law, generally, artists do have the right to say whether or not they recognize a work as being done by their own hand. And I think it's a really interesting question because it sometimes does muddy the water. There are cases in which artists have created works and then afterwards, for different reasons, have denied creating them, whether it's a personal reason. I forget which artist it was, but there was an artist who, I think his ex-wife had one of his works, or had multiple works of his, and out of spite, he denied creating them. He didn't want her to have something of such great value. So artists ultimately do have that right to deny authorship, to deny attribution. However, it really is up to the market. So if an artist is known to deny attribution, even though the market does recognize the work as being by the artist, there are some very interesting things that can happen with valuation there. The market may still see value, even if it's not as high of a value as in the case when an author does recognize a work. So it's really tricky. The issues of attribution and connoisseurship sometimes really do muddy the waters and become really tricky for valuation of artwork.
Now, this idea of private collectors and auction houses making sure that what they have or what they're trying to sell is real, how expensive is that process to even authenticate that this is indeed worth the millions that they're trying to sell them for?
That's an excellent question.
Oh, do you want to go ahead, Jennifer, yeah, and then I'll have Layla respond as well.
I think it depends very much on how in-depth that you have to go. If you're working, for example, on an ancient bronze and it turns out to be made of an alloy that was not available during that period, if it's a Etruscan bronze or a Greek bronze, that can be a very quick process and somewhat inexpensive. But if you have a painting that has a very large palette, it can be weeks, if not months, to do the full analysis, and that can be quite a bit more expensive.
Layla?
I think it's interesting that auction houses and galleries really have to balance these prices. The auction houses do sell works for multi-million dollars, but there are also cheaper works that are being sold, maybe a work for $30,000 that might not necessarily go through the same process of the due diligence, of looking at the science, of examining a provenance, of having connoisseurship. So I think auction houses and these different institutions do balance the price against the price of the work versus the cost of the process. And I think that's really challenging. And I think that's one of the reasons that we'll see a lot of problematic works that are valued at under $100,000, because collectors and art institutions won't necessarily do the same level of due diligence for these less expensive works.
Now, Jennifer, your clients are some of these auction houses and museums. How often, when you start your investigation, that are you giving them the bad news versus the good?
Oh, I hate that question. I do wind up delivering a lot of bad news. I sometimes feel like the opposite of Antiques Roadshow. And in a way, the reason for that is usually people call me in when already somebody's got a question. And so someone from a connoisseurship perspective, or maybe a conservation question, they've seen a red flag. And so they call me in for confirmation. And so it's actually pretty frequently that I'm delivering the bad news. And there is some shoot the messenger out there. People are not happy to receive this news. And so I try to be as kind as possible in terms of breaking the news.
And if a museum is small and they might have something that, you know, they've been marketing as pretty well-known and valuable, that could even tank their institution if it's not something that they thought it was.
I haven't seen that so much in museum collections, but I have seen some private collections. In particular, if a private collector relies on a single dealer and that dealer turns out to be a criminal, then you can sometimes see collections where 70% of the pieces are fake or 90% of the pieces are fake, and that's heartbreaking news to deliver.
Jennifer Mass, President of Scientific Analysis of Fine Art and Senior Consulting Scientist for the Rijksmuseum. Jennifer, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Also, Layla Aminadole, Art and Cultural Heritage Attorney and Professor of Art Crime Law at NYU. Layla, thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you. It was fun to chat about these issues.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Here's a question for you. Did the Vikings discover America before Christopher Columbus? This was hotly debated at one time after Yale announced it had acquired a 15th century Norse map that showed the coastline. We'll learn about the controversy after the break. You can join the conversation too, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up Monday, first Harvey, now Irma. On the next Where We Live, we'll get an update on the latest hurricane to threaten the U.S. Plus, we'll find out what hurdles and opportunities face workers over the hill, but not the cliff, with author Lori Rassis. That's on Monday. Now, today we've been discussing art crimes, including forgeries. Now, forgeries also exist in the academic world, specifically historical documents. Right now, we wanted to look into the mystery surrounding a supposed 15th century Norse map that ignited major controversy when Yale announced its acquisition of this map in the mid-1960s. To tell us more, we're joined from Yale's ISDN studios, Raymond Clemens, curator for early books and manuscripts at the Beinecke Rare Books and Manuscripts Library at Yale University. Raymond, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Tell us a little bit about the Vinland map for our listeners who may not have heard about this.
The Vinland map is a map that looks like a 15th century map that has been drawn on two sheets of parchment that have been joined together. And it represents what was thought to be the known world in the 15th century. What's unusual about the map is that it also has, off to the left side of it, two known bodies, Iceland and Greenland, and then the coast of Newfoundland. So if this were a genuine map, this would be very early proof that the Vikings had arrived in the Americas in the Middle Ages long before Columbus had. This map was given to Yale University by Paul Mellon in 1965. And along with the announcement, it published a book that provided evidence of authentication that the map really was a 15th century map and not a forgery. That ignited protests in New Haven and elsewhere, largely amongst the Italian American community that felt that this was being done in a way to sort of undermine Christopher Columbus. And ever since 1965, there have been debates about the authenticity of the map, both historical and scientific.
So at one time, it was believed to be authentic. What was the process to realize that it wasn't what it was purported to be?
One line was scientific. And what they did was they took samples from the map in 1972 and sent them to a famous lab in Chicago that analyzed the composition of the inks. And that test in 1972 indicated that the inks had a modern component called anatase that was only in production since the 1920s, and therefore the ink itself was a modern ink. So one line was scientific. Another line was historical, and that was looking at what sort of maps were produced in the 15th century and what sort of maps people from the Netherlands, in fact, would have used. And in those cases, we find that maps from these regions were not physical, were not, image maps. They were verbal maps. This was not a culture that produced maps that we understand them, and instead simply produced verbal descriptions of their trips.
And how long after 1965 was it discovered that this was not indeed a true Norse map from the 15th century?
There was immediate refutation in the medieval community and the community of scholars that this was not a medieval map. But there was still a great debate about that, and that debate has lingered, has continued really pretty much to the present.
I wanted to bring into the conversation now Nicholas Bell, Senior Vice President for Curatorial Affairs at Mystic Seaport, the Museum of America and Science, or America and the Sea. Nicholas, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you.
So tell us your interest in the Vinland map and what we can learn from this saga over the decades.
Well, so like many people, I learned of the Vinland map through a television documentary many years ago. I saw it. It was a great story.
PBS documentary?
probably was. I think it was on Nova, actually. And like many people, I thought, wow, that's really interesting. Didn't think too much about it for a long time. And then I came to Mystic Seaport last year, joined the museum there, very excited about that, and realized that not only were we very close to Yale, but also that our immediate past board chair was the son of the curator of maps at Yale at the time that the map was acquired, so had a very intimate knowledge of that whole story. And so we said, you know what, let's just go down to Yale and ask them, what if we did a project about this? Could we do that? And we went down and we talked to Ray and the team at the Beinecke Library, and the response was overwhelmingly positive, that this would be a great opportunity to tell the story of this map, to talk about its cultural importance, even though we now believe that it's a forgery, as well as to bring it out and to put into a place where a large audience could really see it. Because what's often forgotten in these conversations is that so often we're making these conclusions based on seeing it in a book, seeing it on television, reading about it in the newspaper, and it has almost never been seen by the public. So we're really excited to bring it out and put it in a place where people can see the authentic, inauthentic document.
It does spur on an interesting conversation, Raymond Clemens from the Beinecke, because indeed it turned out to not be a real Norse map, but archaeological discovery that the Vikings did make it to Newfoundland shortly thereafter when that map was discovered. Tell us a little bit more about your relationship with Mystic Seaport, with this upcoming exhibit, and why it's important to talk about this context.
So I think the most important thing to take away from this is that even if the vast majority of scholars who have expertise in these fields agree that the map is not authentic, it still had a huge cultural impact in the United States in terms of starting to turn the conversation around to the idea that Viking explorers, Norse settlers, reached the shores of the New World long before Columbus. So this is 1965. It's October 1965, the day before Columbus Day, when this news is announced by Yale to the world. You can imagine the firestorm of controversy that ensues. And yet, only a couple years prior to that, archaeological digs at L'Anse aux Meadows in Newfoundland had been underway that were finding true, authentic archaeological evidence that, in fact, there was a Norse settlement in Newfoundland around the year 1000. And so the irony here is that even though the map turned out to be inauthentic, the story that it told about Norse exploration was largely true.
Raymond Clemens from the Beinecke, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely fascinating because unlike the earlier speakers that you had on who talked about a profit motive in forging artworks, we really don't know who forged the Vinland map, and that makes it sort of interesting. Why were they doing this? Was this sort of an exercise? The sagas mention Leif Erikson's trip to Newfoundland. Were they simply trying to, you know, reproduce that in a map? We really don't know who forged the Vinland map, and so I think that's one aspect of it that's really fascinating. And then the other, as mentioned, is that it becomes a key document in the 1960s and the sort of unrest and debates that are taking place in America about race and culture. And they mirror what's happening today, because as Columbus Day rolls around again, there'll be debates about, you know, was Columbus really the, quote, discoverer of America? There were obviously people living here for centuries before Columbus arrived. So there's a very interesting contemporary story, and Mystic Seaport has the ability to reach a much larger group of people than we're able to at the Beinecke Library, which is an exhibition space but also a research institution. And Nick is right. The map itself is kept off display largely for conservation reasons. The inks that were used to draw it are very faint. And so it's actually sort of difficult to see, and we don't want to expose it to too much light because we don't want to degrade it further. We still want to do analysis on it. We still want to, you know, make sure that future generations are able to use technology and perhaps give us better answers about the way the map was forged.
We know that the Norse map is a forgery today, but tell us about what the Beinecke Library is doing, collecting other documents that may be forgeries and what you're learning from them.
Yeah, the Beinecke, I know this sounds odd, but actively acquires all sorts of forgeries. Because
intentionally now.
Well, hopefully intentionally. Obviously, every institution acquires forgeries unintentionally. That is pretty much unavoidable, as your earlier segments indicated. But we're very interested in forgeries because they tell us a tremendous amount about the culture that forges them and about the culture that believes in their authenticity. So, for example, one of my colleagues, Catherine James, has been collecting what we call the William Henry Ireland forgeries. And William Henry Ireland died in 1835, and he produced thousands and thousands of what he claimed were original manuscript documents written by William Shakespeare. All of these were horrible forgeries. If you look at them today, they look awful. They don't look anything like we would expect Shakespeare's hand to look. But what they speak to is a huge desire in the 19th century to authenticate Shakespeare, to have something in his actual hand, because, in fact, we have very, very little in Shakespeare's actual hand. Almost everything we have is print, and even the print is often a generation removed from Shakespeare himself. So that's part of the reason the Beinecke collects known forgeries, is because of the historical value of them.
And Nicholas, go ahead.
Lucy, I think it's important to add that as knowledge increases and as generations move on, we come to documents with different eyes. And so one of the first things that we discussed when we got into a room with Ray and the team at the Beinecke was how we could look at the Vinland map today and see it differently than we might have in the 1950s or 60s. And something that I think is really interesting, Ray, that you had described is how clearly it appears to us today to be a fake, as opposed to how it might have looked to medievalists 50 or 60 or 70 years ago.
Yeah, that's true, largely because most medievalists didn't look at medieval maps. There weren't a tremendous number being produced, and so it wasn't really within their ken. And so if you were to ask a medievalist or a Renaissance scholar what does a map look like from the period, they probably wouldn't have a great body of knowledge to rely on. And that was because cartography really was a nascent field in the 50s and 60s regarding medieval documents. And so, you know, 30, 40 years later, we've done a lot of research. Most medievalists have seen maps, color maps, beautiful reproductions. And so we have a much better sense of what a map from that period looks like.
I'm really fascinated now to see the Vinland map for myself. And again, we can do that next May. Is that when the exhibit's rolling out?
The exhibition will open at Mystic Seaport next May. It'll be open through September. We're really excited to present this and present it in a cultural context that helps understand why it had such a huge impact at that moment in 1965 and how it continues to ripple out across different communities. Also, we really hope to provide some of the education that Ray is talking about, so helping people understand how do you make a parchment? How do you make medieval links? What are the tools that we can use to educate ourselves as to why these documents look the way they do, so that when future examples come up, we're all better tuned to looking for those clues.
We're almost out of time, but in terms of this upcoming exhibit at Mystic Seaport, again, the Vinland map will be displayed next to actual Viking artifacts from a partnership with the Swedish Museum. Can you tell us quickly?
That's right. That's right. So one of the ways this conversation first came about with Yale is we were looking for something of a bridge between Norse history and American history. And the reason we were looking for that bridge is we had already come to an agreement with the Uppsala University, which is the oldest university in Scandinavia. It's in Sweden. Their museum, the Gustavianum, is putting out their Viking collections for a global tour. And the first stop on that global tour will be Mystic Seaport next year. So these are artifacts that date as long as 1,000 years to 1,300 years ago that have never left Sweden in history. So we're really excited next summer to bring those out to Mystic Seaport and allow people an opportunity to have a firsthand experience with that material.
Well, I want to thank Nicholas Bell, Senior Vice President for Curatorial Affairs at Mystic Seaport, the Museum of America and the Sea. Nicholas, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Lucy.
Also, Raymond Clemens, Curator for Early Books and Manuscripts at the Beinecke Rare Books and Manuscripts Library at Yale University. He joined us from the studios at Yale. Raymond, nice to speak with you as well.
Thank you so much.
Our show is produced today by Carmen Baskoff. Special thanks to WNPR producer Lydia Brown and our technical producer, Kion Wolf. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Learn more about the show at WNPR.org/where we live. As always, thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.